The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra, where today we'll spend most of the pod looking at the proposed Newcastle United takeover. We'll also get Archie on to talk about the Bundesliga and keep you up to date on everything that's happening with Project Restart. Barry, nice to see you as always. How are you?
I'm very well, Max. Thank you.
You're growing into your hair.
Do you think?
Yeah.
Somebody at TalkSport, actually, on Sunday, assistant producer Jess, said it really suited me having a crew cut because it gave me edge. And I must say, I left TalkSport Hours with a spring in my step after being paid that compliment because, let's face it, I don't get many.
No, you don't. But do you want another compliment?
Take all I can get.
I quite like reading out the odd nice message from listeners who appreciate what we're doing. This is one. My name is Terry. I've listened from Portland, Oregon since the Jimbo days. I feel compelled to reach out to say thanks for keeping Football Weekly going. Your review of old matches inspired me to gather a group of old friends and teammates to watch a high school match from 28 years ago. Many of us had not talked in 25 years or more. We fell right back into easy conversation as the beers went down. We all agreed the footy we played was awful. Maybe it was the pitch. Either way, thanks for all that you do, Barry, and the cast as well. Another one from Peter, who says, I love the tributes to Baz last week and felt genuinely moved to hear all the voices from over the years. I live overseas from my friends and family. Lockdown has been at times a lonely existence. The pod and all the contributors have been like the chance to catch up twice a week with old friends about the football, a welcome boost of positivity during such a challenging time. Thanks to you for all your insight. I don't think insight is aimed at either me or you, Barry. That's everyone else. And humour, hopefully we cover a bit of that. We'll definitely contribute to the Football Weekly Fund on The Guardian to keep the bear and the ubiquitous little shit. I think it was obsequious little shit. Either way, we know I'm a little shit of some sort on air for a long time to come. Thank you to both of you. Greatly appreciated.
Very
and thank
kind.
You also to the gentleman in Singapore who I think must have pressed the wrong button on the website and donated quite a significant amount of money for The Guardian.
Obscene amount of money. I really hope it wasn't a mistake, but if it was, you're not getting it back.
When you press go to checkout and then you feel sick inside.
I was feeling slightly guilty about my contributions to The Guardian during lockdown compared to, say, Sid, who seems to be churning out an interview every day with one superstar after another. Then I heard about this very generous gentleman in Singapore who contributed to the fund on the back of our contribution to Football Weekly, and my guilt is gone. I've paid for myself for the next 20 years.
GU.com/footballweeklypod if you want to donate to The Guardian. We're obviously aware it's a difficult time for lots of people, so do not feel obliged at all. Right, let's get on with the pod, and we'll begin by looking at the proposed Newcastle United takeover. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Let's talk then about the proposed Newcastle United takeover. It's a pod I've wanted to do for quite a long time. It might ultimately come down to what you think a football club is for and the point of being a football fan, but there is a lot to unpick in a subject that ranges from Middle Eastern politics and human rights abuses through TV piracy, Mike Ashley, Uber, all the way down to just a football fan who wants to watch their team. It's obviously a very emotive issue, and in lots of places it's turned very quickly into a shouting match, and I just wanted us to do it in quite a measured way. To do it, we're joined by Alex Hurst, who's the chairman of the Newcastle United Supporters Trust. Alex, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Max.
And James Montague is here, journalist, author of the Billionaires Club, friend of the pod. How are you, James?
Yeah, I'm doing all right. It's a beautiful sunny day.
Yeah, lovely day here too. Well, you're in Lowestoft, are you, on lockdown?
I'm in the most easterly point of Great Britain.
Marvellous.
So
it is now nearly 2 months since the consortium contacted the Premier League for approval, a process that's expected to take around 30 days. The Saudi Public Investment Fund is a body chaired by Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who would own 80% of the club, while the millionaire-backed UK company Rubin Brothers would hold 10%, and with the financier Amanda Staveley's company PCP Capital Partners. Sean Ingle broke the story on Monday night about the takeover being in doubt after the World Trade Organization ruled that the country is behind Be Out Q, a pirate TV and streaming service that offers illegal access to sporting events. We will get to that. But Alex, can we start with you first? Obviously, you can't speak for every Newcastle United fan, but explain who the Supporters Trust are and who you represent.
Yeah, the Supporters Trust are a members organisation. It's only £1 for membership, and we exist to represent supporters in direct communication with the football club, so that in an ideal world, the football club can have some sort of formal dialogue with its supporters about a range of issues that specifically represent supporters. We have over 10,000 members, which is great. Picked up most of those in the last year. I got elected to the board, and I chair the board. So we kind of direct the trust, its strategy, and try to direct its relationship with Newcastle United.
And how much dialogue have you had with the club while Mike Ashley has been in charge?
Depressingly little dialogue, frustratingly little dialogue. Funnily enough, I might get bitten on the arse for this one, but they have talked about us meeting Mike Ashley in May this year, before coronavirus kicked off. So we thought we were making some kind of progress there. It was going to be an informal meeting that involved beer, because that's how Mike likes it, apparently. but sadly, that might never happen now. Devastated about that one. But yeah, it's been really, really tough. And a lot of the decisions Newcastle United seem to have made, not just in the last 12 months, but before that, seem to have been almost deliberately antagonistic towards the fan base, which is a strange thing to do as a football club. But that's where we've found ourselves, unfortunately.
So what would you say is the general feeling about this takeover?
The general feeling is one of absolute delight and euphoria. I think there's two parts to it. The first is that, you know, Mike Ashley could be being replaced by yourself, Max, and everyone would still be absolutely delighted. The fact that he's leaving gives tens of thousands of people a chance to reconnect with a really important part of their life. I mean, I know people who've disengaged with the club in 2008 when Mike Ashley did what he did to Kevin Keegan. There's all these kind of waves of things that have been the last straw for some people. And you saw, you know, up to 10,000 empty seats in St James's Park this season, which even during the decade of failure under Ashley, that's been unprecedented. You know, it wasn't really picked up in the media too much, but the club actually gave away 10,000 free season tickets this season, which is just mad when you think about it, that's what they've kind of been compelled to do to fill the stadium. So it's really positive that so many people are so excited and once again want to engage with the football club. So in my opinion, and from what we see in our membership of the Trust, people are really, really, really pleased about this takeover. The added factor of a supposed incredibly wealthy benefactor probably adds to that excitement factor. It definitely does amongst a lot of fans. Though, you know, at the Trust anyway, we try and consult and speak to members all the time. There are lots and lots of people who are very excited about this takeover and also hold concerns about the proposed people who are supposed to be taking over the club, and what kind of role they will have in the club and how Newcastle United will sit in their kind of infrastructure.
James, should Newcastle United fans be excited about this takeover?
Yeah, I mean, in some respects, I can understand why they are. I mean, you know, I've been following Ashley over the past decade, and he's an extremely, he's a man that elicits a strong reaction from people, not well liked, not even outside of football. Newcastle fans are desperate to get rid of him. He's been trying to sell the club. I remember seeing him in Dubai, I think, in 2009, when he was trying to sell the club even back then, like hanging around in bars, in hotels, trying to meet a sheikh that was going to turn up to sell the club. But yeah, I think the new owners are incredibly problematic. There's no doubt about it. There's what has to be tempered is the feeling of wanting to get rid of Ashley with who are the people that are going to take over the club? Why are they taking over the club? And what will it do to the long-term reputation of Newcastle United? And I think that is incredibly problematic, because MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, the man who will ultimately control the club, ultimately own the club, is someone who, you know, compared to Ashley, compared to the owners of Manchester City, compared to even Qatar and PSG, these are people who have an extremely long and bloody reputation when it comes to human rights, when it comes to culpability in the murder and dismemberment of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi. And there's obviously a discussion about, you know, I mean, you've got Yemen, you've got all sorts of, I mean, there's a long trail, there's a long record that's out there. And I don't think we've ever had an ownership that has come into, or a potential owner that's come into the Premier League that has such a baggage with them that is kind of irrefutable. And so it's something that people have to discuss amongst themselves, or that's something they want to accept for their football club. But, you know, these aren't benevolent people. They're doing this for a reason, and their track record so far illustrates that, you know, they're pretty ruthless, and Newcastle United is part of a wider plan which doesn't have anything to do with Newcastle, has nothing to do with its fans, and it's really got nothing to do with football.
Alex, do you think, when you hear that, do you think you or Newcastle United fans should be conflicted about this? I can completely understand the desperation to get rid of Ashley, but do you feel conflicted yourself, or do you feel you should be?
Yeah, I mean, from a personal point of view, you know, I don't obviously disagree with anything James has said there. You know, the fans I speak to, and people are, you know, or the supporters, you know, around the region on social media, it's very easy to disassociate yourself from all of that stuff, because every football fan's different and everyone views their club and consumes their club in different ways. The easy answer many fans would give to James there is, you know, well, we don't get to say who owns the club. Take Mike Ashley. What has he done as a billionaire to help my football club? I would say nothing. And I think teams in the Premier League, and particularly, do they need rich benefactors, you know, with the money that, you know, they should be self-sufficient with the money that they've got coming in. So I wish we had a say in who Mike Ashley sold the club to, but we don't. So regardless of how I feel about it or how certain fans feel about it, does it actually matter? That's what they would say. You know, Saudi Arabia has from what I read, I'm not an expert, has a strong diplomatic relationship with the United Kingdom. It's a crucial and strategic ally in the region. And none of that makes anything that James says wrong, or I'm not disregarding it. But a lot of Newcastle fans feel like it's one rule for, like you mentioned, you know, various other businesses across the world that everyone seems fine using, like Uber, like Disney, like owning parts of the independent newspaper. It's one rule for them, but then you want to come to me, a football fan, who has no say in any of this. And I wish it wasn't so. You know, I'm a huge believer, you know, probably unsurprisingly, in fan ownership. I believe that even part of fan ownership would be something the government and the Labour Party, the last two elections, have kind of championed this, although it wasn't kind of widely reported. Even part fan ownership would be a massive step forwards in terms of how football clubs are run. But everybody else in the game doesn't really seem bothered about that. And that's okay. That's fine. I'm all right with that. But all of a sudden, you would like, you know, me and Newcastle fans to talk about this, which is fine, and we can engage with it. But ultimately, you've come to the very bottom of the pile, in my opinion. I wish it wasn't so. I wish we had more say. I wish we had more influence in who ran our football club. So many fans are just going to say, it doesn't have anything to do with us. So, you know, we could, you know, you could go to Mike Ashley and speak to him. He's the one who's going to get a third of a billion quid reportedly here for selling the football club. You could go to, you know, to BT or Sky, the guys that turn over hundreds of million pounds by showing these matches. We're the ones who don't get asked about all this. And it's nice that you're asking me now, essentially. You know, that's great. And it's nice to have this platform. But football fans don't have any say, particularly at the top level in the Premier League, who owns their football club. So that makes it easy for fans to just say, well, nothing to do with me. And some fans are outraged about it. Some fans are even talking about disengaging from the football club because of this. But in my opinion, they're an extreme minority. It doesn't mean I'm wrong that they're a minority, but they are a minority. And lots of people just look at the football pitch and what's going to happen with the football club, because to them, that's what's relevant here. Anything above that and beyond that, and things that happen thousands of miles away, to them, it just seems like an alien question.
I have noticed that quite a few Newcastle fans seem to think that there's some sort of media agenda against the club, and that journalists are only sort of being outraged, possibly for want of a better word, or exasperated, say in my own case, about this because it's Newcastle. And I'm going to quote Michael Martin here from the True Faith website, and I like reading his stuff. I really like reading his stuff about Mike Ashley, but he said in an article, in short, this takeover completely debunks the myth propagated for years by a snide and ignorant London media, with its attendant regional class prejudices hardwired into its thinking. And it's as if to suggest we're only doing this because it's Newcastle. But do you not think that the same concerns would be raised if Saudi Arabia wanted to take over West Ham or Crystal Palace or QPR? Because they certainly would, you know, London clubs. And the media in general, this snide and ignorant London media, fawns over Manchester United, Liverpool, Manchester City, teams like that, who aren't anywhere near London.
Yeah, I mean, on the media thing, obviously the media is a wide and varied beast. You know, I think that there are a number of articles which I can point you towards, which Mick is probably talking about there. Nothing, I think, from you guys. And I know Louise Taylor, you know, wrote an excellent piece for The Guardian last night or this morning about all this and is covering it really well from that respect. I think a lot of fans point to the Manchester United example, that when the news broke, 2018-19, that Saudi Arabia were going to buy Manchester United for $2 billion. In 2016, it was Liverpool. Although obviously it was a far less advanced stage than this, which I understand why people might look into it more, because it seems like, you know, it's with the Premier League now, it's at the final hurdle. There didn't seem to be any kind of, or certainly in such detail, the kind of exposure or investigation that there is now. And I think fans look at that hypocritically. You know, they point to certain journalists who, you know, at True Faith have been on podcasts to give their side of view, and that's great. At other newspapers who did write about that Manchester United takeover, was somewhat with a more excited and, you know, let's look at the potential feel, compared to this one, which has been very focused for reasons that have been, you know, quite rightly pointed out, that have nothing to do with football. And I suppose it's where does that line fall between, you know, football media and political, or not even media, but football and politics. And I absolutely accept the argument that politics is ingrained in football. But also over the past 10 years, particularly as Newcastle fans, and you look at, you know, maybe not so much the written media like you guys, but broadcast media with commercial radio stations, which I'll not mention the name of, you know, have gone out of their way to belittle Newcastle fans. Not everybody on those radio stations, there are some great people on them, but others on there have gone out of their way to belittle Newcastle fans. And I suppose that's where that kind of north-south divide comes from. But you make some good points to Hibari about the other football clubs mentioned. That, you know, that it's that kind of attack mentality, isn't it? You've had 10 years of kind of being ignored. I mean, I've done more media in the past 4 weeks than I've done in my whole life about Newcastle United, and talking to people such as yourselves and newspapers from around the world, from Australia, from Canada, from Germany, from the Netherlands, from Denmark. And a little bit of me feels like, yeah, I understand the questions you're asking, but where have you been for the last 10 years? And Mike Ashley, by the way, is not MBS. And for whatever is supposed crimes are in his retail empire, you know, I wouldn't for a second equate him to the type of things that are being proposed, you know, that James is talking about before. But I also think there's a huge misunderstanding sometimes in the media. Newcastle fans don't hate Mike Ashley because he's a bad employer, a sports director. They are things that are used to beat him with, because the football arguments have ultimately fallen on deaf ears. Newcastle fans also don't hate Mike Ashley because Newcastle are shit. Newcastle have been shit for most Newcastle supporters' adult lives, with the odd couple of years under Kevin Keegan and 2 seasons under Bobby Robson. Being rubbish or being bad, it isn't new for the vast majority of us. Mike Ashley, and I know this isn't about Mike Ashley, but, you know, this is a guy who has lost 2 tribunals against club favourites in Kevin Keegan, and even worse, Jonas Gutierrez, who was managed to prove in court that he was managed out of the club, essentially, because he had cancer. They're the reasons people hate Mike Ashley. It goes beyond just being a bad owner. So I often feel when I'm speaking to all these people, that's fine, I'll answer these questions for you, and it's great, we can talk about these things, we can talk about Newcastle fans. But all of a sudden, there's this massive worldwide media scrutiny, and a lot of Newcastle fans are like, whoa, where's this come from? And you know, you'd probably rightly say, well, this is a global issue, because it's not the first time, by the way, because you have Qatar at Manchester City, and I know there has been media scrutiny of that deal. And, you know, I think when they beat Watford 6-0 in the final, there was a lot of stuff then about what Qatar had gone to the game. But it isn't on the same level as what we're seeing at the minute.
James, can I ask you, does Alex have a point in an answer he made a few moments ago, that it shouldn't come down to Newcastle fans, to just football fans who want to go and watch a football match on a Saturday with their mate or their dad or their mum or whatever, to make these political statements, when, as he says, the British government have we have a working relationship with this country?
There is a huge amount of hypocrisy around Saudi Arabia and Britain's relationship with Saudi Arabia, but it is incredibly problematic. There's no doubt about it. I mean, we have, you know, as long as I've been a journalist, the past 15, 20 years, there have been discussions about the type of investments that we make there, our kind of relationship there, corruption, and in particular, the arms trade. I mean, the arms trade is a multi-billion pound industry that we benefit hugely from. Saying that, that's also wrong. You know, saying that a British court has also outlawed sales of British arms to Saudi Arabia since September last year, something the British government is trying to overturn. Now, I wouldn't necessarily use the British government as a benchmark for morality in this case. It has shown itself to be pretty venal time and time and time and time again. Going back to about the media stuff, I think that what's changed massively, I mean, the Jamal Khashoggi incident has turned something which might have been reported in the same way that the interest in Manchester United was, or before then with Liverpool, it's turned it into something much more explosive. And the fact is, if it was Manchester United we were talking about right now, it would break the internet. That what we're seeing at Newcastle United would be ramped up 1,000 times. So I don't think this is anything to do with picking on a team that, because it's not Manchester United, because Manchester United sells papers, or Manchester City. I mean, I certainly don't come from that position. I come from someone who's worked in the Middle East. I've written about Middle Eastern football pretty much my entire career, so I know a little bit about this world and the type of people that invested in clubs. Should it come down to fans? Of course, the main problem in this entire situation is that British fans, English fans in particular, have been completely stripped of any power within football, especially at the highest level. They have no say. As Alex said, you know, the Supporters Trust, I'm a big supporter of the Supporters Trust movement. The Supporters Trust are not listened to. They're not listened to at the highest level. I recently wrote a book about ultras, and if you talk to the Crystal Palace guys who are trying to set up an ultras group there, they've got no space in the stadium to have any kind of engagement or any kind of space to exist at all, like they do in almost every other European country. And so it's a one-way street. It's a one-way street where you're a consumer, and that's it. And that's how English football at the very highest level has been set up. This wouldn't happen in Germany because it has a 50+1 system where members have much more of a say. I mean, they wouldn't be able to take over an 80% share in the first place. So I understand how powerless fans feel. But ultimately, it's different buying a football club than it is to buying a stake in Uber or a stake in a newspaper, which I also think is quite problematic, by the way. But it is different because who owns your football club matters. The morality of them matters. How they conduct themselves matter. The way Ashley has conducted himself, as you mentioned, not just in his business dealings, but also in how he approached kind of employment tribunals with ex-players and ex-coaches. These things matter. They've mattered since football owners have existed. And, you know, the morality of what might be the future owner of Newcastle United is going to be reflected. It's not going to be something that's going to go away if this deal goes through. Every time something bad happens in Saudi Arabia, which MBS is intimately involved in, it's going to be reflected on the club and it's going to be reflected on the fans. Now, that they have so little space to do anything. They really, the only power they have is to boycott. That's it. That's the only power they have, as the Liverpool fans did when they boycotted the £77 ticket at the 77th minute, which worked. But there's a very small amount of movement there. But there has to be, I think, a recognition that what is happening here is that the club is being bought as a tool. It's being bought as something that the Saudi government wants to exploit to change its reputation post Jamal Khashoggi, so people will invest in Saudi Arabia. And I think that at some point there has to be a discussion about where Newcastle fans sit on that, because for me, if it happened to my club, I'd be extremely conflicted. But I'm not sure I could go to a football match if that happened. I'm not sure if, I mean, that's somebody coming from a position where I'm not exactly an expert, but I mean, I know quite a bit about that part of the world. So it's one thing saying, okay, we have no power in this system. It's another thing saying, okay, let's separate the success we're going to have on the pitch to what this man is doing a couple of thousand miles away, because it will rebound on the club and it will reflect on the club. And that's something that we will see in the next 5-6 years if this deal goes through.
A couple of things, James. One, you interviewed Khashoggi's fiance, who has written to the Premier League and also to the Newcastle fans. She said to the Newcastle fans, "My plea to you is to think whether accepting Mohammed bin Salman's offer is really the right way out of the despair for your club and city. How can it be when your club will be controlled by someone who should be tried for murder, as we would rightly expect for anyone accused of killing a loved one?" Can you tell us about that interview?
Yeah, I mean, I spoke to Hatice Cengiz. I wrote a story for The Athletic about this because I contacted her after she basically posted a Twitter post that urged people to kind of stop Mohammed bin Salman buying Newcastle United. And the reason was because obviously her fiance had been kidnapped, murdered, dismembered by a team attached to and connected to MBS, who the CIA and the UN Special Rapporteur on extrajudicial killings have concluded most likely were commissioned by MBS. And so she hasn't spoken out against PIF deals with Disney or Uber or any other of these companies, because those are investments and almost silent investments. But this was recognised by her as something which is different. This is an investment that is not about profit. It's not really about football or glory. It's about trying to change an image of a country which, if we're honest, probably has one of the worst PR reputations in the world after Khashoggi. After the Yemen conflict, where MBS is directly responsible for the deaths of tens of thousands of innocent civilians. So she recognised straight away that this is something that they're trying to do to try to put Khashoggi to bed, the issue to bed, and that this is something that will stop her from trying to get justice for his murder. And that there hasn't been any justice for his death. So she's in a very difficult position because obviously it's not something you're ever going to forget. And it's something that she's going to live with for the rest of her life. And, you know, the kind of response that she's received so far has been, you know, it's been quite difficult seeing some of the responses to it. But I think we've got to be very, very, very careful about blaming Newcastle fans for that, because there's also another game going on here, which is there's a misinformation media war going on, a social media war. Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates as well are two of the countries that have the most advanced cyber capabilities in the world in terms of attacking and minimising discussions online. Khashoggi even called these his flies. So when he posted something on Twitter, because he had something like millions of followers, he would be attacked by Saudi troll farms to try and drown out the message. And so there's a lot of people online who are purporting to be Newcastle fans who have got MBS in their avatar and Saudi flags in their avatars who aren't Newcastle fans. And it's made this entire debate really difficult to kind of like tiptoe through, because as Alex will tell you, that what's online is not what the match going Newcastle United fan necessarily believes in. Those are two absolutely separate things. But for her, it's absolutely an open and shut case, is that how can you let a man who is responsible or has been accused of being responsible of such a heinous crime own a football club? And I don't think there's a good answer to that, because I don't think somebody who's done a crime like that should be able to. And I think it is ultimately going to harm Newcastle United in the long run by having somebody, because this isn't going to be the last of his mistakes. Every time a busload of children is blown up in Sana'a, every time a female activist is tortured in Riyadh, this will reflect back at Newcastle United. This will carry on, and maybe the fan base will kind of like, you know, lock down and try to weather the storm and blame it on the London-centric media or, you know, leftists or whatever. But the fact is, this is to come. And so I think it's important that Newcastle United fans know that this is the direction that it's going to go in if this goes ahead.
Alex, does that worry you?
I don't think most Newcastle fans are overly fussed about the club's perception around the world in terms of what people think about it. I think this is true not just of Newcastle fans, of most football clubs, and I can't speak for all football fans. If your team is successful on the pitch, the vast majority of fans will purely engage with that. Now, that's not me saying that's myself. That's not me saying that's right. I think that is a fact, though. So the reaction of Newcastle fans to all of the things that James has just put forward there will probably be linked to how well the project at Newcastle does. Now, there are going to be two directors at the club from PIF. Neither of them MBS, you know, for a variety of reasons, I'd imagine. And this takeover, even though, like you said at the top of the show, Max, 80% PIF, Amanda Staveley is the face of this takeover. I'm led to believe she is the person that is going to be running the club on behalf of the other investors. And I think a lot of Newcastle fans will engage directly with that rather than the kind of stuff you've just talked about there. And yeah, like you say, you made a point there about, you know, should Newcastle fans let this happen? Is this the kind of thing we want to let happen? I think a lot of fans will just turn around and allude to the point I made earlier. We don't get a say. So it's so easy to kind of ignore, and I use that word, probably ignore, all of the things you've talked about. Now, for most fans, a lot of people listen to this, other fans, members of the Supporters Trust who've been in touch with us, engage with it and understand it and are appalled by it. But the vast majority of fans will look at this from a purely football perspective and think to themselves, well, I'm engaged as a consumer, I'm a supporter of the club, I'm going to judge them by what they do at Newcastle United. The other stuff isn't relevant to me as a supporter. Now, again, there might be people listening to this who think that's abhorrent, that's awful, but that is how the vast majority of football fans view things. I don't have a problem with that personally, to answer your question, Max.
I think it's a bit of a stretch to expect us to believe that Newcastle fans don't care what the public perception of them is around the world, because the evidence of recent months suggests they're obsessed with what other people think of them. The reaction Miguel Delaney gets any time he pipes up springs to mind. He's been quite vocal on this, and he gets rounded on by Newcastle fans who are clearly care an awful lot about what people think. If they didn't care, they wouldn't care what he wrote. They wouldn't be bothered by it. And I appreciate the distinction James makes between Newcastle fans on the internet and these, you know, bot farms orchestrated by Saudi Arabia. And there's something I wanted to ask you, James, is I've noticed on Twitter that some have accused Jamal Khashoggi's fiance of being on the take from Qatar, and others have questioned just how much of a relationship she was in with him. Could you put either of those to bed?
Yeah, I mean, this is a talking point of the Saudi media, that she was a Qatari agent, that she was a Turkish agent, because since basically this comes down also to what's been happening with the Gulf blockade. So a few years ago, Saudi Arabia and the UAE led a coalition to kind of ostracize Qatar for a number of complex historical reasons, but I mean, in large part driven by jealousy, but a kind of a long-standing kind of power dynamic between those countries. And so what's happened is that there's been this complicated media war that's been going on, trying to first kind of UAE and Saudi coalition kind of criticizing Qatar, and then Qatar has kind of responded in the same kind. So anything like this in the Saudi media, for instance, you know, they've brought out Jamal Khashoggi's son on several occasions to question the relationship that Hatice Cengiz has had with Jamal Khashoggi. And it's worth mentioning that, you know, his son, the children of Khashoggi, were initially banned from leaving Saudi Arabia. There was a forced kind of photo op with the eldest son with Mohammed bin Salman. At the moment, we've got an issue of Mohammed bin Salman essentially ordering the house arrest of the children of a former leading intelligence figure from Saudi Arabia, who was a potential rival, who's now living in exile in Canada. So this is all part of the misinformation campaign. I mean, there's no doubt she was his fiancée and that he was going there to get the documents, to get them married. But it's all about muddying the water. And then what's the saddest thing I've seen kind of stories in media which is controlled, which is propaganda. Websites like Al Arabiya or the Arab News, for instance, which write these stories and then are being shared by Newcastle fans online, because they want to find something that will counter somebody's testimony that I think makes people very uncomfortable. So, I don't think there's any doubt about the facts of the case, but of course it is being muddied in this information war that's taking place, which Newcastle is now, you know, is now part of.
Just to comment on the online nature of all this, I think, first of all, you know, any Newcastle fans, genuine Newcastle fans out there who've sent abuse or put mental questions like that about Khashoggi's fiance or abused Miguel Delaney or anyone else, are a disgrace. What happens online, we have found this out in the past 10 years at Newcastle United with numerous boycotts that have failed to get off the ground. When the whole of Twitter is boycotting and it comes to match day, and I kid you not, 250 people walk in late. And that doesn't mean, you know, the Liverpool one's probably the best example that James references earlier. I think the lads at Liverpool said about 10,000 walked out then, which is great, but still only a quarter of that at the time of the match going crowd. So just to Barry's point about, you know, it being a bit of a stretch that Newcastle fans don't care. You might be right, Barry. You probably are right that the fan who frequents social media and Twitter in particular, and this kind of constant news cycle and constant comment that's required on Twitter, yeah, those people are very, very, very bothered about this. But other representative Newcastle fans as a whole, I don't think so. I don't think the vast majority of Newcastle fans will know who Miguel Delaney is. Excellent journalist that he is, by the way, a nice guy. And to be fair to Miguel as well, and not that he needs a plug on your show, but he wrote some excellent pieces about Ashley, and he put some real time into that. So I knew Miguel before all this happened, and he has covered both sides. And I think that, you know, attacks on him by some Newcastle fans have been totally out of order. But there is this massive differentiation between what you see online and the real world, particularly in terms of football.
I mean, no one wants their club to be an object of derision or to be disliked. And Manchester City fans, you know, they care about what people think of their club, and they get upset when people accuse them of being nouveau riche and Arrivas and whatnot. And I'm not necessarily just talking about people online. You know, I referenced Michael Martin earlier, and I don't want to pick on him, but, you know, he clearly cares what people think of Newcastle, as referenced by, you know, his description of the London media and our apparent attitudes towards the club. I mean, I've long thought Newcastle would be a brilliant club to buy. I think the same of Sunderland, although not so much these days, but, you know, because it's a big club, the only club in a city with a huge fan base. It's quite cheap by football club standards, 300 million. For me, it's a no-brainer to buy Newcastle, because if you invest in it, you could make a hell of a lot of money. I don't think that's why Saudi Arabia are investing in it, but that will be a byproduct of their investment if it goes through.
That's an important point, I think, that hasn't been mentioned yet, is the similarity between Manchester City and Newcastle. And also, I think there's a very real feeling that if PIF invest in Newcastle in the way that Sheikh Mansour's ownership of Manchester City invests in East Manchester, then there's a huge benefit there for the city, a city that's long been neglected, you know, something that's gone back 3-4 decades. And here's someone, unlike, you know, London, unlike the money which is concentrated in the southeast of the country, which has abandoned it in many respects. This is somebody who's going to come in and invest in it and love a city as much as they love it. So that is something that is a very real thing. And it's one of the reasons, I think, that Manchester City fans have so kind of, obviously, success. I mean, winning the title, winning the treble, you know, playing in the Champions League group stages almost every year, that has its role as well. But in terms of like what seems to be kind of a very deep love for an ownership, which itself is incredibly problematic and is itself using the club for very different means, the love is real. And what I guess I'm a little bit worried about is that, yeah, these conversations that we're having now, you know, about how fans feel and how we should feel morally about this, is that 2-3 seasons down the line, we'll see what's happened to Manchester City, in that it's like a bunker mentality. Any criticism of it is that you're a Qatari paid shill. It's Fortress City. Like when it turned out, when UEFA decided to ban Manchester City for 2 years because, you know, the documents from Football Leaks had allegedly shown them to be kind of getting around financial fair play, there was no dissent. It was just, this was a conspiracy against the club. It was racism, anti-Arab racism. And what I fear is that level of polarisation is going to happen down the line, because Manchester City has really drawn the blueprint of how to do this. But my other point is that there's also, I guess, a word of warning for Newcastle fans as well, because there's a big difference between Qatar, the UAE and Saudi Arabia. In a way, Qatar has been extremely successful with PSG, the way it's run it. The World Cup, it was extremely successful in winning the bid to win the World Cup. It has had huge amounts of criticism since because of worker rights. The issue of kafala, by the way, is far worse, far more severe in Saudi Arabia than it ever was in Qatar.
Sorry, just explain what that is, James.
So kafala is basically that a worker is completely beholden on an employer for being there for basically everything in their lives. It's a way that workers, mainly from Southeast Asia, South and East Asia, are exploited in the most awful, terrible ways. I mean, I visited labor camps all across the Middle East. It's an issue that's come mainly to the fore because of Qatar, because this system of workers is building the World Cup infrastructure and stadiums, and they have been hammered for it, you know, since 2010, mainly because they won the right to win the World Cup, and so it brought this kind of issue to the attention of the world. But the issue that isn't really talked about is that the situation is far worse for workers in the UAE, and worse of all in Saudi Arabia, in terms of numbers, in terms of treatment, and in terms of kind of any kind of reform to the system. It doesn't exist. But the point is, I'll go back to the UAE, the people who run Manchester City, Khaldun al-Mubarak, you know, you've got the you know, people who are involved in the running of the United Arab Emirates run Manchester City. They're extremely competent people. The danger for Saudi Arabia is that although Mohammed bin Salman has acquired power, and he's done some, you know, or has ordered some pretty awful things to happen, he's also made mistake after mistake after mistake in the direction that Saudi Arabia is going. He started an oil price war with Russia when oil prices have collapsed, for instance. He started the Qatar boycott, which has blown up in his face. The Yemen war is an absolute disaster. This Vision 2030 project that he wanted to bring in to try to wean the economy off of oil, that stalled. Investment has stalled because of the Jamal Khashoggi case. So the other worry is that, yeah, they might come in and buy the club, and Amanda Staveley is a very talented deal maker, but I'd be worried about how the club would be run, who's going to run the club, and I don't think you're going to have the same level of competency, or my fear is there won't be the same level of competency at Newcastle United that there were at other clubs. And that, again,
I mean, I suppose they'd be used to that, at least, you know.
So it's not that's the danger, is that this could be for nothing. You could have owners come, because it's always, when I wrote the Billionaires Club, it was the one thing that was really interesting talking to people, fans, when they had a bad owner, was, you know, it was about getting that owner out at all costs. But almost in every single example that I came across, and Portsmouth was a great example of this, was the person who came next was worse. You know, and it wasn't until the Supporters Trust came in and basically saved that club and that's not a model necessarily that can be scaled up to the Premier League, but it was only until their Supporters Trust came in, saved the club, and really showed that supporters could run a club up to a certain level in English football, that problem, you know, was solved. But then what happens? A billionaire comes in, Michael Eisner, offers to buy the club, former CEO of Disney, and the former discussions about whether the fans having their club back, they're all gone. And they voted to have that because there was a chance of success. So I would just be very wary of, because Newcastle United and the Saudi ownership, I don't think it's necessarily going to go in the same direction as Manchester City.
Just want to touch on this piracy thing. Louise Taylor writing today's paper, and Sean Ingle broke the story on Monday night. Premier League has received an advanced copy of a World Trade Organization report, which it's understood makes a direct link between the Saudi government and the pirate service BeOutQ, which has illegally streamed Premier League matches transmitted by Qatar's beIN Sports. Now, beIN Sports has a £500 million 3-year deal with the Premier League. Javier Tebas, president of La Liga, has urged the Premier League to consider the damage that BeOutQ's pirating and broadcast has caused the sport before deciding the takeover. Richard Masters, now the Premier League CEO, this is Louise writing, finds himself in a diplomatic tight spot. Reject the deal and its exciting new football narrative, and PIF could well initiate legal action, pass it through, and, well, you bite the Qatari broadcast hand that feeds you. Alex, are you just sitting here thinking, we've been so close to takeovers before and this might not happen again?
I don't have any information, or, you know, I don't know how things work within the Premier League. I'd find it bizarre that the PIF of Saudi Arabia and the Rubin brothers and Amanda Staveley would not have foreseen this coming. You know, we're reading Louise's article and others about this has been rumbling for some years now in terms of court cases and all kind of stuff. So I would assume that before they put down their £18 million deposit or whatever it was in the club, they knew this was coming. As a football fan, and in terms of the Premier League, it's quite funny, isn't it? Because I understand why the Premier League hasn't engaged with Amnesty or any other organisation on human rights. You know, and I admit it, I want this takeover to go through. But then as soon as money becomes involved, it seems to be that, all right, we have to look into this, even though there's a guy called Bill Bush. I watched a YouTube video of him kind of bragging about how much money, the fact that the Premier League brings in more broadcast revenue than like the BBC, the Guardian, you know, the Times, the Daily Mail, all of them pushed together. So on one hand, you've got, well, we make so much money, we're so good for the country. On the other hand, it should be, well, this is a serious threat to us. We need to make even more money in these countries. And it's just kind of, it's a little bit, you know, typical of how the Premier League works. But it is what it is.
How do you see it playing out, James?
It's incredible to me. And Alex is absolutely right. The hypocrisy of this, I mean, it stinks on so many levels. I mean, the fact that something like, we've talked about the human rights issue, that doesn't matter in the directors and owners test, owners and directors test. What matters is the bottom line of the Premier League being affected because of piracy. Again, we talked about this earlier about competency. I wouldn't assume necessarily that just because they're involved in the deal that they're necessarily particularly competent. I mean, you know, lots of these kind of mistakes are made. But for me, I think Louise is right, is that the political fallout, because of some of the issues that Alex mentioned earlier, especially the UK government's deep relationship with Saudi Arabia, if the Premier League decides to stop this because of piracy, it's a political bombshell. The British government will not allow this to happen. They will intervene in this somehow, because ultimately the amount of investment we take from Saudi Arabia is too great for them to allow that to happen. It's too much. And also, we've got to realise as well, we're going to be, we have a post-Brexit economy, and money from Saudi Arabia is going to be absolutely vital. So they might make that decision. In fact, they might even make that decision knowing that the government is going to come back, and then they can, there's some fudge will be made, and it will go ahead. So I think the deal, if it's real, will go ahead, but ultimately, I think it might take government intervention for that to happen. And, you know, I think it's quite sad that it's piracy and not other issues that people are taking seriously at the Premier League. But this is something that's been talked about at the owners and directors test for years. I remember Thaksin Shinawatra when he bought Manchester City. And there were all sorts of human rights issues around there, which were far less problematic than here. But they've changed the rules mainly to stop kind of people who have had, you know, kind of not necessarily convictions, but could have been convicted of a crime in a certain country. They've changed the rules to bring that in, but there's been no human rights element. And, you know, I think we have to wait to hell to freeze over before the Premier League and Richard Masters would introduce something like that.
Finally, Barry, if it was your club, would you stop supporting them, or would you boycott, or would you walk away?
I would. Personally, I would. I wouldn't inflict my view on anyone else, but I just couldn't. I wouldn't, with a clear conscience, be able to go and cheer on a team that is being bankrolled by Mohammed bin Salman. So, yeah, I would walk away. Now, look, I'm a Sunderland fan. I'm nominally a Sunderland fan. I rarely go to see them play. But if it was possible, say, for Mohammed bin Salman in some way to get his hands on the Offaly hurling team, I would never go and watch them again as long as he was the boss. And not only that, I would want them to lose every game they played under his stewardship. That's my personal opinion. People will say I'm a wishy-washy liberal, but that's the truth. You asked and I'm answering.
No. I mean, I have, because that's the thing. I feel the same. I feel that if it was Cambridge United, that I would. But it's very easy when I am not a season ticket holder anymore at Cambridge United. I don't go every week. It doesn't define my life. It's not. It's a huge part of my life in a nostalgic way. But I feel so much sympathy, Alex, for Newcastle fans who didn't want to have to deal with this moral decision. And I completely understand why they might not. Because it's very easy for me to say, it's almost like if MBS took over the amateur team that I've played for the last 16 years, which would be a strange political decision for him, that would be harder for me to accept. But I wonder, Alex, if you think anyone will, or if there will be any protest or anything like that, or if these conversations make you question things yourself, because it's not easy, and I don't want you to feel sort of put upon by any of it.
No, not at all. It's been a great conversation, and conversations worth having. And, you know, we at True Faith, we reached out to Amnesty International and they came and did a podcast with us, and they said kind of the same, that they don't expect any Newcastle fans to stop supporting the club or boycott or not go. They just want Newcastle fans to engage with the kind of stuff James is talking about, to recognise that it happens and to read up on it. I think that's a completely fair enough thing to ask fans to do. I promise you that if this takeover goes through, you know, even if Saudi Arabia don't pump in tens of millions of pounds, if Newcastle United is just run sensibly and for its own benefit rather than for the benefit of a sports shop and advertising purposes, I think the club will thrive. And, you know, the demand for tickets at St James's Park is going to go through the roof. It doesn't mean there aren't fans out there who aren't like Barry. I know some of them, so they do exist. But it's an extreme minority. It doesn't make them wrong because they're a minority, but that is the situation.
I mean, I was quite wary of the fact today. I didn't want Alex to think he was walking into an ambush, and I hope he doesn't. And it has been a really interesting discussion because James and Alex are both bringing a particular levels of expertise and knowledge that I don't have to the table. I suspect the same as you probably feel the same.
Yeah, Matt. Completely. And appreciate both your time as well. Thank you, Alex. Appreciate it. Thanks for coming on.
Cheers. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, James.
No worries. Anytime.
We'll be back in part three where we will discuss the Bundesliga. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. So Bayern Munich now unbeaten in 13 in their quest for a record-extending eighth straight league crown after their 1-0 win at Borussia Dortmund. 7 points clear at the top with 6 games to play. Let's talk to Archie Rintut. Archie, how are you doing?
Very well, Max. Very well.
That goal by Joshua Kimmich, right? The first time I've made a kind of involuntary noise about a bit of football in months. I think I shouted, "Oh, stop it." It was a delight, wasn't it?
It was. I have to say, when you're in the stadium at that point, it's a shame that you don't have fans there, because usually that's the moment when everybody gasps and kind of just draws breath and the ball seems to hang even longer in the air. And I mean, it still did seem like that on Tuesday, but it was brilliant. I didn't quite think that Roman Bürki, the Dortmund goalkeeper, deserved the criticism that he got, because nobody was expecting him to do that. And sometimes I think you've just got to applaud the brilliance of the speed of thought of Kimmich there. But it was outstanding, wasn't it?
Where does that stand on the pantheon of... Because you messaged me going, it's no Clint Dempsey. I mean, I know you're biased here, right?
Whoa. Okay. Tell me that the Clint Dempsey goal against Juventus, for the moment, for the goal that it was. Okay. It wasn't Gigi Buffon in goal for Juventus. It was Antonio Chimenti, right? Put that aside. But that was a better moment than this.
Oh, of course, better moment than this. I'm just thinking in the sort of pantheon of great chips. Trust me, Dempsey is up there, right? It's right up there. I'm thinking Hoddle v Watford.
I think Lee Dixon against his own goalkeeper. That's got to be up there.
And is that classic Josh Kimmich? Does he do that a lot?
No, not really. He's got this bullish warrior quality to him. As this kind of little terrier, I would say, a very, very skillful and perceptive one as a midfielder as well. He's made a name for himself at right back as well, but been shifted more into the central midfield position now this season with Benjamin Pavard, the World Cup winner with France, coming in from Stuttgart at the start of the season. But yeah, it was a wonderful goal to cap off what was, for me, an incredible first half, with an intensity that I didn't expect both sides to play with, given what was at stake here. But they both absolutely tried hammering each other, I thought. And I thought that Bayern did always look that little bit more dangerous. But at the same time, Dortmund had their chances. I spoke to Torgan Hazard and Lucien Favre, the coach, after the game. And they were just saying what was missing was that final pass, that little bit of movement, and just taking a shot. Lucien Favre has got these principles of wanting to shoot in from certain places on the pitch, i.e. very close to the goal and very quiet and really quite central. And you could see that by the way that Bayern were kind of just packing the box in terms of just that central third, in like, you're not going to have a shot from here the whole time. But Bayern Bayern just looked that little bit more consequent in the final third, and actually, I think that's what told in the end as well.
Yeah, I was disappointed Borussia Dortmund didn't win, actually, because just to keep the contest going, the league going as a contest, but what was more disappointing for me is, sort of like Archie says, I think they could and possibly should have won. And do you think, Archie, they were, is it just Bayern being Bayern and they were intimidated out of the contest, or was it just bad luck?
I think they hesitated too much in these areas where they were getting into. There were lots of chances which, if we were talking about a match of the day highlight package, they wouldn't have necessarily got into it because it was the pass before it becomes a chance. But there were so many of these moments. But the issue is that Bayern are so good at creating just these fine margins that, like, if you're going to score against us, you're going to have to play the ball so precisely that it's going to have to be world class. And you saw that in terms of some of the late blocks that they had. I did think Bayern were really good, but also, you know, I remember some skills in the first half from Mo Dahoud beating two Bayern midfielders with a nutmeg and whatnot, and like a last-ditch tackle from Lukas Piszczek. Generally, all of Dortmund's kind of most showboaty moments came in inconsequential areas of the pitch for them going forward, and that's the issue. Don't get me wrong, this Bayern Munich side is very good. Right now, I make them favourites for the Champions League. And having somebody like Alphonso Davies is a cheat code within a game. Because every time you think that a player is through, suddenly he comes screeching in and you're like, how's he got back? Like, his pace is unbelievable. And also, I think his whole story coming from Ghana as a refugee to Canada and the way that he worked his way up there, like, he certainly, I know, I mean, in Germany, Bayern Munich are just despised unless you're a Bayern Munich fan. He certainly adds a very likeable sense to this side.
Richard Jolly's first tweet of the pod. If Alphonso Davies were to run at his top speed versus Borussia Dortmund of 35.3 kilometres per hour, he could cover the distance from Durham to Barnard Castle in 75 minutes and 45 seconds. Sancho came on. He looked a bit off the pace, didn't he? Erling Haaland struggled up front as well. But Bayern's squad, we got a question from Robert saying, when will we see the ultimate five subs in one go? Now that football is back, who would get confused first when it's made, the ref, the commentators, or the fourth official with the board? But Bayern were just bringing on brilliant player after brilliant player after brilliant player. Their depth is ridiculous, isn't it?
Yeah, it's quite good when you can bring on a World Cup winner for a World Cup winner in Lucas Hernandez coming on for Jerome Boateng, for example, Javi Martinez coming on for Gnabry. But I would say that actually the players that Dortmund were bringing on were probably more important to their side. I think you had pretty much a first choice Bayern 11 out there. Maybe with Thiago being out through injury, Niklas Süle as well right now. But I think that if you gave Hansi Flick an opportunity to make any changes to that side, there's just a really lovely balance to it. But you talk about Erling Haaland. He seemed to be on a different wavelength to his teammates. He wanted the ball played quicker. I saw him getting annoyed with Thorgan Hazard on a couple of occasions. Jadon Sancho, he did look off the pace, but to be honest, only confirms what Lucien Favre did with him, i.e. he started him on the bench because he said he wasn't fit enough, because Sancho has had this injury for the last month or so during lockdown and has had to be eased back into training. So that Dortmund missed their two first-choice central midfielders in Emre Can and Axel Witsel from the start. But that said, I thought that Dortmund did well. The margins that were lacking here were really not that much. And to make, I think, a big conclusion that Dortmund were so far off it is not the case, because I think that it was just really fine margins that they were lacking here.
And is that the title race done, in your mind?
Knowing Bayern, it has to be. 7 points clear with six games to go. When I spoke to their coach, Hansi Flick, after the game, he was still saying, no, we've still got to get this done. Dortmund weren't conceding it either. But look, they do have two or three difficult games left this season, Brian. They've got to go to Leverkusen, who, despite their 4-1 loss to Wolfsburg during this midweek round of matches, will give them a game. They beat them earlier in the season. And also, Borussia Mönchengladbach have to go to Bayern as well. Add to that that Uwe Rösler's Fortuna Düsseldorf, I think, are looking much better than their position in the table, and they've got them this weekend. The issue is, can you see this Bayern Munich side dropping that amount of points in the rest of the season? No. I think this is Bayern's title.
And you interviewed Thomas Müller afterwards, and he did a really good impression of Roadrunner. It wasn't just he said Roadrunner, but actually when you analyse his impression, it was superb.
Yeah, completely. although I've since been reminded that apparently Meep Meep is an inaccurate quote from Roadrunner.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like, such is the way of Twitter being able to bring you down. Apparently it's Beep Beep, but it's commonly misquoted as Meep Meep. But yeah, I thought Thomas Müller is one of these people who, when he's in the zone and when he's kind of in flow like that, both on the pitch and off the pitch, because I thought that Müller had a fantastic game as well. He's a joy to watch and a joy to talk to as well.
Give us a roundup of everything else that happened, please, Archie, in about sort of 45 seconds.
Okay, so very quickly, starting at the top of the table in terms of the top four places, everyone behind Dortmund, who could have put a little bit of pressure on them for the Champions League places anyway, managed to trip up. You had RB Leipzig tripping up against Hertha, who have suddenly come into very good form since Bruno Labbadia took over during the lockdown. They drew 2-2 against them. Borussia Mönchengladbach dropped points away at second from bottom Werder Bremen, drawing 0-0. And Leverkusen, who I mentioned there, they got absolutely hammered at home by Wolfsburg, who are in sixth, but they're still 11 points behind Leverkusen after this. At the bottom, huge win for Fortuna Düsseldorf and Uwe Rösler. They beat Schalke by 2-1. Schalke are having their worst ever second half of the season. They've not won in 10 games. This is the first time they've gone 10 games without a win in 23 years, I think it is. They're in a terrible state right now. But yeah, at the bottom, it's looking quite interesting. Paderborn are all but relegated. Bremen are 5 points from Fortuna Düsseldorf in the relegation playoff spot, but they've got a game in hand, Bremen, against Frankfurt, who are only 7 points above them, but that could obviously be down to 4 points if Bremen win their game in hand.
Finally on Germany, Archie, you want to bring some shithousery to the pod?
Yes. Paderborn's Klaus Jasula picked up his 15th yellow card of the season on Wednesday night, meaning that he is now just one away from equaling the record of Tomasz Hajto and two away from becoming the all-time Bundesliga yellow card record holder. And also, because unlike in England where you'd get a 3-match ban for 15 yellow cards, he's only got a 1-match ban for this one. So still plenty of time for Klaus to go and break the record this season.
You'd go for it, wouldn't you? I mean, if you've come this far, you want to get it.
How would you do it in style? Would you wait until like the 86th minute of the final game, stay clean as a whistle for the rest of the season, you know, and then just a really obvious handball and then just 2-foot one for someone in injury time to get the record and walk off the pitch, throw your shirt on the floor and go, that's it, I'm the champion.
The best thing about him as well is that because he broke his cheekbone at one point earlier in his career, he wears it's not a scrum cap. It looks more like something that a gladiator would wear before. And I'm talking 90s TV show Gladiator, before kind of entering the gauntlet. And so I don't know if he even like has to wear this in the same way that Cech had to, but it just kind of gives him this fantastic look when he's timing all these challenges so poorly that I'd love it if he kind of just, like, I don't know, steamed in head first or something just to break the record.
Stick.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Remind listeners of his name again, to who to look out for?
Klaus Jasula.
Klaus Jasula, my new favourite Bundesliga player. Right, Project Restart. Earlier in the week, Premier League shareholders voted unanimously to resume contact training Here's their statement. It marks another step towards restarting the Premier League season when safe to do so. Stage two of the return to training protocol has been agreed following consultation with clubs, players, managers, the PFA, LMA and the government. Today, Thursday, is another important day. That's when all other aspects of Project Restart will be discussed, including the league's contingency plans on relegation, the issue of the use of points per game and the award of the Premier League title if the season has to be curtailed. Meanwhile, Jamie Jackson and Paul McInnes writing in the paper that a group of clubs led by Liverpool will argue against paying a £330 million rebate to Sky and other broadcasters at a meeting to discuss the matter. That's also today, Thursday, despite the Premier League's recommendation that it should be accepted. As it stands, Sky and BT have the rights to 47 remaining games. The remaining 45 will be shared, with Sky wanting to broadcast 32, BT Sport wanting to show 8, and the remaining 5 being split between Amazon and the BBC. And Troy Deeney has gone back to training. It was obviously probably the most high-profile player, him and N'Golo Kante, I guess, but Deeney back in training after discussions with medical experts at his club. Some desperately sad news from the Football League is that Morecambe defender Christian Mbulu, who's died at the age of 23, former Motherwell player, began his career at Millwall, also played for Crewe. In a statement, Morecambe described Mbulu as an extremely popular member of the squad and said news of his sudden and untimely passing has been a shock to us all. All thoughts, of course, with his family and friends. Meanwhile, in League One, still no final decision on what should happen. The Tranmere chairman, Mark Palios, Tranmere, of course, are in the relegation zone. But are on a fantastic run of form, if anyone can be off form, having not played for a long time. Under points per game, they would go down. He has devised a different plan, which surprisingly would mean they wouldn't go down just. Although I interviewed him on Saturday, and he sort of made some very legitimate points that, you know, there are teams in League Two who will go into the playoffs under points per game who have a chance of getting promotion. His side, who are so close to safety, under this would just be relegated like that with a lot of the season to go, but still no decision there. On Thursday night, Denmark will become the second country after Germany to restart their league season. AGF Aarhus welcoming local rivals Randers. In front of one stand, there will be a giant screen 40 metres long and 3 metres high filled with fans on a giant Zoom call. I think we suggested this as an idea as a kind of joke, but actually it seems brilliant. Supporters have signed up for free tickets to take part, can even choose their preferred section of the virtual stand. Two smaller screens will allow for neutrals and away fans to be there as well. A quote from the club saying, imagine a big Zoom meeting, 10,000 people with their microphone on. He says it'll be white noise. So they're trying to work out the audio, trying to create an atmosphere and encourage fans to sing in unison. So good luck to the people of Denmark. We'll be watching how that goes. Do you want two more Richard Jolly tweets to finish the pod?
Yay.
One from earlier this week. Dominic Cummings travelled further in lockdown with coronavirus than Crewe Alexandra have ever gone for a competitive game in their 143-year history. And another one from Richard Jolly. Douglas Ross, the first MP to be an assistant referee in Iceland, Albania, and resigned from the government in protest about an illicit trip to Barnard Castle. thank you, Richard Jolly. Finally, a question from Phil. If you were Prime Minister, which of the pod would fill your front bench and in what roles? Barry, I sent this question to you and you stopped researching any other part of the pod and focused entirely on this.
Yes, I spent about an hour trying to fill my cabinet. The one thing I've noticed is Jonathan Wilson would be doing a lot of heavy lifting on my front bench. But I think I'd probably have him as Chancellor of the Exchequer, A, because he's tight bastard who'd shit in your kitchen and charge you for it.
That's true.
And he would spend every penny as if it was his own, so he'd be a good man. I have to say, I'm doing this for... I'm going into this with a view of being PM who wants to do good for the country, not just look after my mates.
Right, okay.
Boost my own ego. Yeah. Barney as Home Secretary, I think it'd be hard but fair, except for various times when he isn't necessarily fair.
I had Barney as special advisor on the premise that he looks most like Dominic Cummings out of all of us.
Ooh, that's brutal. Wilson in as Transport Secretary as well, just because he spends so much time on trains and buses providing running commentaries on how bad they are. Sean Ingle as Secretary of State for Digital Culture, Media and Sport, just because he was at the forefront of the Guardian Sport Digital Revolution. Secretary of State for Women and Inequalities, Jackie Oatley, I think, has to get that job. Secretary of State for Defence, Kate Mason from Sky Sports News. Not because I think she'd be a particularly good minister, but just because she's utterly bonkers and would be good crack at a cabinet meeting, telling us all sorts of inappropriate stories about her personal life. Oversharing, Kate. So, yeah, they're the ones that I have so far.
Well, I put Philippe in the DCMS because he does music as well. He's a cultured man, isn't he, Philippe? I had Lars as Chancellor because he's obsessed with statistics. And then I just got silly and had a Minister of Meat, Mark Langdon, and a Minister specifically of Ham, Sid Lowe. So it's got very meat-based. Anyway, you can let us know what you think below the line if you want to. And that'll do for today's pod. Archie, thanks for doing part three.
Thank you. Cheers.
Barry, thanks for doing all of it.
You're welcome.
And we'll be back on Monday. We are over the weekend watching, for Man United fans, we do owe you, we're watching the Champions League final of 1999 with Kate Mason and Lars Sivertsen, and we'll look back at that on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.